All right, so we're continuing on here at Splash 2011 with William Cook.
Hello.
Hey, thanks for coming on Channel 9.
Thank you.
So for people who may not know, you know, some of the things you've worked on, why don't you give us a little history?
Okay, so I am a programmer, first of all.
Excellent.
And I programmed in high school, I programmed in college, and then I started learning a little bit about theory and formalisms, and eventually, when I went to grad school at Brown and
nice.
Did my research on the foundations of object-oriented languages. And so my dissertation was on the semantics of inheritance.
Mm.
And it was very lucky for me. I got a great topic and was able to formalize what inheritance is. And it was a point in time when C++ and Smalltalk were having a lot of influence, but it was still very difficult to communicate what object-oriented programming was.
Mm.
There was this phrase people said, oh, you just have to do it for a while and then you'll have the aha experience.
Okay.
And so the teaching was quite difficult.
Mm.
So I think I had that aha experience, but I had some denotational semantics formal tools that allowed me to write down the aha experience in a way that you can communicate, at least to people who know denotational semantics. So that's
fair
part
enough.
Of the problem, is that people don't know the theory, so it's hard to communicate it.
Well, communicate it.
All right, so I could do it if I had a piece of paper. It's a
oh,
there's
fair
this
enough.
Beautiful picture, but it, essentially what it has to do with is that if you have a self-referential or recursive definition and you want to modify it, you can do that by wrapping it with a delta or a change. And the problem is that when you do that, if you want all of the clients to get access to that modified behavior, then what you have to do is also change the self-referential access of the object to itself.
Okay.
It also needs to see that modification.
Mm.
And so that's what inheritance does. It changes the self-reference of a, when a parent class uses self-reference, the subclass makes a change, the parent, the self in the parent is redirected to refer to the methods in the child.
Okay.
So that's the basic idea of inheritance, is modifying a self-referential structure.
Excellent.
Okay, you can do that to types, you can do it to classes, you can do it to modules.
Yeah.
It isn't necessarily even specific to object-oriented programming.
Interesting. So of course this leads into mix-ins, right?
Exactly.
Tell us a little bit, you know, for people who might not know what a mix-in is, because many of our viewers don't use languages that support
mix-ins. Yeah.
So talk to us.
So mix-ins is not something I invented. It existed before in a language called Flavors, which was a dialect of Lisp.
Okay.
And they had this interesting thing. It was called Flavors because back then in Boston, there was the whole ice cream mix-in thing. Do you know about this?
I don't.
That I can't remember. I think it was Steve's Ice Cream. And they used to, you'd order your ice cream, and they would slap it out onto a stone board, essentially, and then you'd say what flavors do you want added to it? And so you could take chopped up Oreos or sprinkles and stuff, and they would whack it and pound the stuff into the ice cream and fold it over and then make this mixed in ice cream and then deliver it to you.
Excellent.
And this was like the rage in the late 80s in Boston.
Okay.
And so I guess some people at MIT saw this and created a language called Flavors that allowed you to mix in behaviors to a class. And it was kind of named after this ice cream thing.
Excellent.
So I was able to use my formalism of inheritance to analyze these languages. And essentially what it comes down to is that if you think of a subclass makes some changes to its parent class, okay, but those changes might actually be reusable. What if you wanted to have a subclass that, for example, implemented memoization? Okay, that's a generic thing that it could do for its parent class, but you could apply that memoization to multiple different superclasses. So a mix-in is a reusable subclass.
Interesting.
It's a parameterized subclass.
Huh.
That you can take that sort of added functionality and mix it in to multiple parent classes.
Great.
So it's an interesting idea, and it's related to multiple inheritance, actually. You can think of it that way as well, because one of these sort of reusable subclasses can be applied to multiple parents, and you can have multiple of them applied to a given parent, and they all contribute their additional or modified behavior.
Interesting.
So there's another thing more recently called traits.
Yes.
Which is essentially a form of mix-ins as well.
Okay.
And Scala has traits. So it's a topic that has been sort of fermenting for a long time, mm-hmm. and occasionally pops up in various places. But it in some sense it hasn't completely hit the mainstream.
No.
Even still.
I mean, it seems like it could be something that would be useful in this web programming age with the dynamic languages.
Yeah, it's possible. It's definitely possible. So anyway, to go back to my history. So I did that work. I was in grad school and finished my PhD in 4 years, and then I went and worked at HP Labs, and I had a lot of trouble publishing. This is one other funny thing I like to tell people about, is that the initial paper on my thesis work, I submitted 4 or 5 times and got it rejected over and over and over again.
Interesting.
Because I did not know how to write. They would all say, oh, this is a great idea, but we can't quite get it. And eventually I got somebody who sat me down and helped me learn how to write.
Excellent.
And after that, I published 8 papers in a row without any interruption. So it was the semantics of inheritance, mix-ins, this thing called F-bounded polymorphism, which is a way of doing essentially inheritance at the type level and dealing with recursive types. That's now in Java as well.
Okay.
I did some stuff on analyzing class libraries and refactoring class libraries, very early work on that.
Great.
Analyzed interfaces, the role of interfaces in object-oriented languages. Mm-hmm. And I also wrote a very funny little paper on comparing abstract data types with objects.
Interesting.
And that was based on some earlier work by John Reynolds, and that is what turned into the expression problem. If you've heard of that.
Yes,
Phil Wadler then read that paper and renamed it and called it the expression problem. Phil has a great knack for naming things. I mean, he's really brilliant in general, but one of his particular forms of brilliance is to come up with great names. So I published this paper and identified the concept but didn't have a catchy name for it. So it didn't really catch on until Phil kind of reinterpreted it.
Excellent.
So then the fun thing is I did those 8 papers and then I dropped out. Of academia completely, and went to work at Apple.
Okay.
And I got involved with this project called AppleScript.
Ah.
And so I was the lead engineer architect on AppleScript.
Okay.
And so the reason I did that was that I really wanted to learn how real software development was done. Mm. And Apple had this interesting project that I had some skills related to, and so I joined up with them and really learned about testing and documentation and build control, source control, all the different things that make you a real developer.
Absolutely.
And so that was a lot of fun.
So now what happened with AppleScript? I mean, I personally don't know much about it.
Yeah. So AppleScript was a language that was designed to do for GUI environments what the shell does for Unix. It allows you to pipe together and connect applications.
Interesting.
So the idea is we've got these big GUI applications that are also like libraries or tools. Mm-hmm. How do we hook them together? And so we invented a language that allowed applications to talk to applications. And AppleScript was one of the earliest embedded scripting languages.
Interesting.
In an environment. So you could do 2 things with it. You could integrate 2 different languages together or 2 different applications together, or you could use it just to customize an application as its kind of native scripting language.
Okay.
And then that got, right around the same time, and maybe a little later, but kind of feeding off each other, was Visual Basic for Applications.
Yes.
So it's a similar role. So the other problem was that, Apple is kind of a home run company. They love products to be perfect and to be home runs. Mm. And AppleScript was not a home run. And so what Apple usually does with non-home runs is kill them. But AppleScript proved to be a little difficult to kill.
Okay.
And so it's still alive and kicking even now, despite various attempts on its life.
Yes.
But it's funny, because I actually discovered that I am not really a home run kind of guy. I'm more of a Microsoft guy.
Okay.
Funny, because Microsoft, they're...
We don't make home runs? What do you mean?
No, you don't.
Okay.
You develop initial versions that are usually not very good, and then you relentlessly improve them until they are amazing. Okay. It really is a different style, and that's the way I like to work.
Okay.
I like to do something and then make it better and make it better and make it better. I don't like to, you know, kind of polish until it's perfect and then ship it. So anyway, it's an interesting style.
It is.
I didn't really fit in very well at Apple because of that. And so I left and the whole team left.
Interesting.
And AppleScript continued to run without bug fixes for about 7 years.
Wow.
And then eventually they got a team that could recompile it.
Okay.
And pulled in one of the co-architects. Warren Harris was sort of the co-architect on that. And he went back and showed them how to actually build the thing so they could fix it.
Cool.
So,
that's an interesting
anyway.
Idea.
So then I did startups.
Okay.
I got involved in a multimedia startup that flamed out. It was called BAM Software.
Okay.
We did a product for teaching middle school students how to write for Prentice Hall.
Huh.
But it was a fun, kind of early, big multimedia application. That's still on the market today, as far as I know.
Okay.
And then we morphed into another startup, and then eventually some people I've been working with founded an enterprise software company called Allegis.
Okay.
This was in the late 90s. And we focused on partner relationship management.
Okay.
Which is indirect sales channels, big companies that sell through resellers and VARs and agents.
Okay.
And so we essentially built a tool that allowed those really big companies to interface with the little companies. Because when we would go to our customers initially and ask them, you know, what do you know about your resellers? They'd say, oh, Sally down the hall, you know, has a spreadsheet. And that's all we know. But they're the people who are, you know, actually selling your products. And so we made a system that enabled them to do essentially joint forecasting and selling and marketing and stuff
Excellent.
Like that. Our customers were HP and ViewSonic and Microsoft.
Nice.
Actually was a
good
one used in the channel.
Okay.
In Microsoft.
Now what did you use to develop this tool? What was your
It was all Microsoft. We used Microsoft Transaction Server.
Interesting.
1.0.
Wow.
And Microsoft SQL Server. And we were really jazzed. We had a great time. The thing that was interesting about Allegis, and it was really fundamental, is that we, at this time in the late 90s, we looked around and just came to the conclusion that object-oriented programming was not the right approach to developing these kind of web-based enterprise applications.
Interesting.
It was great for the infrastructure, but at the level of actually defining the workflows and the security and the user interface, you know, the high-level application-specific stuff, it didn't seem like writing lots of objects was the way to do that.
Mm.
And so what we did was we invented some domain-specific languages. So we had a, you know, pretty typical, we started with the foundation, a lot of people have a data modeling language that described the data model, and it had invariants and conditions and semantics in it, so it wasn't just structure. But then we coupled that with a user interface language that allowed you to write user interfaces at a level of abstraction that was closer to what a designer might think about a user interface, okay? And so this was, it looked a little bit like a template language.
Okay.
But it had some interesting features. For example, in between the user interface language and the data modeling language was a security language, a rule-based security language that acted like an aspect, okay? And it got woven in to the data and the user interface in a very, you know, so you in a very intimate way. You'd specify them separately, but then when they ran, they would all get run together. And essentially what we did is we wrote interpreters for these languages and optimizers. So we actually took the user interface, merged it with the security, and compiled that all into a constant number of SQL queries. And so this was all, because it was all sort of dynamic, static analysis of the program, it wasn't objects. And because it wasn't objects, we were able to write analyzers that could do query optimization.
Awesome.
And so it just ran really well. We had, you know, shared nothing, application servers hitting a database server with very efficient SQL. Basically, every page would have a constant number of SQL queries. And so no matter how much data was on it, you'd always get a predictable amount of data access. And this was like a revelation to me. that this worked. And we were able to change this application and rev it and migrate it and support multiple customers. It was really an amazing experience. I had a team of about 60 engineers.
Wow.
We got, well, that was our peak. Okay. We got $60 million in venture capital.
Nice.
And we're funded by Benchmark Capital. And so we had the whole thing going. We had customers, we had revenue, you know, about to IPO.
Great.
And the stock market crashed.
Oh.
And, you know, we actually made it through that. We still had customers. Things were going pretty good. But the VCs like to, you know, when there's a problem, their attitude is grow your way out of the problem. Mm. Here's some more rocket fuel, you know.
Yeah.
Spend money. Go, go, go.
Yeah.
And we couldn't grow our way out. Made some business decisions that weren't right and ended up having to sell the company for very little money. So, you know, you hear the stories about the people who win in the startup world, but for everybody who is successful, there's 10 people like me who are almost successful.
But this is actually a really interesting point, because it sounds like your startup was, not that most startups aren't like this, but my point is, it seems like you came into the startup with really solid theoretical understanding and engineering chops run by engineers, as opposed to, say, when you have a startup where you have the right balance between great engineers and visionary engineers, and also the people that can do the same level of production, but from the business side.
Well, actually, we did have some really great business people. So
okay.
I haven't mentioned them because I'm a techie.
Fair enough.
But no, Dennis Ryan was our CEO.
Okay.
And he now is a position at PopCap Games.
Okay.
He is amazing.
I've heard of him.
I mean, we...
just the luck of the draw, then.
Yeah, I'm just saying. We had good people. We had amazing salespeople.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot do what those salespeople did.
Sure.
They can't do what I did.
No.
But, you know, we hired really good people. And one thing we did was we had a very aggressive interviewing style where we would just grill people. Because this was trying to hire somebody in 1999 was really difficult. Because everybody, there was so much opportunity. The best people were all involved with stuff.
That's right.
And we had an interview process that was so intense that when people got through it, if they got through it,
yeah,
they would say, I want to work for these people. if you're able to interview like this,
yeah,
you know, this is an experience.
Excellent.
You know, let me come here. So it was very good.
So from the, just to kind of keep on this for just a second, because it's interesting.
Yeah.
You know, at Microsoft, we have this, we have kind of the all day long interviews, and for the engineers, you know, it gets kind of complicated.
I've interviewed at Microsoft, actually.
Okay, so you know, excellent.
Yes.
In some sense, what do you look for if you're hiring an engineer? So obviously, you're a good engineer, you have all the basic understanding, you can write algorithms, you can solve problems.
Yeah, no.
What else?
So we, essentially our interview process was to ask very hard technical questions and ask ambiguous questions that enabled us to tell and scale them. So that you'd like ask an initial question and then ask a harder one and a harder one and a harder one. And so it was like a ramp, and we saw how far they could get,
okay,
how quickly they could go. We didn't necessarily want to have them know the answers necessarily, but we wanted them to tell us their thought process,
okay,
and engage in a dialogue with us. Mm-hmm. So we did a sort of an algorithm question that scaled up to talking about you know, virtual memory, you know, behavior, and how are you going to make this fast? And and then we did we had them read code, C code, and just read it. You tell a lot from that. And after that, they would think, oh, good, I've made it through. And then we'd say, no, we're going to give you a user interface problem.
Oh,
and make them, you know, talk about how would you design a user interface. Mm. And then we would do a database design problem. And everybody had to do all four of these problems. And, you know, if you're depending on your skills, you may do better in one or the other, but
sure,
it's testing your kind of broad vision, your broad view of the space.
Excellent.
So,
all right, so let's go on, let's move on to now the more in the present. You're at University of Texas?
Yeah, so I left Allegis in
2003,
and I had this experience, as I said, with these domain-specific languages, these interpreters, and I just thought, I need to get into academia and study this stuff in a conceptual way as opposed to a startup style. Because we were just building it as fast as we could, and we didn't have a lot of time to reflect and think about what it meant.
Okay.
But So I thought it was time to go back to academia, and got a job at the University of Texas, and it was very difficult. It was, I was miserable.
Really?
For about 6 months.
Huh.
And I called up, Microsoft actually, a recruiter called me and said, we want you. And I interviewed, mm-hmm. and it was like they gave me an offer. Mm-hmm. Everything looked great. I was about to sign, and that last moment I just kind of chickened out and said, I'm going to stick it out a little bit more. I started to collaborate with some people at UT and got some money. It's like the whole mindset, everything was different. I didn't know how to write an academic paper anymore. I hadn't published a paper in 10 years. Mm. It was actually surprising that I got the job because I hadn't done anything in 10 years. You're not supposed to get an academic job unless you've, you know, demonstrated sort of a consistent output. But I think they figured, well, he did some good stuff in the past. Maybe he'll do it again.
Yeah.
So they took a chance on me.
Good.
And so I stuck it out, and I'm a little bit of a chameleon. You know, you put me on the brown branch, and I turn brown. That's the industry. You put me on the green leaf, and I turn green.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So it took me about 8 months to change from business to academic mindset, but it was still in me. So I made that transition. And then I tried. Then the problem became, how do I translate my industrial experience, these problems, these issues, into something that's academically relevant and publishable? Because it's not, you know, you can't just take a business problem and publish an academic paper about it. You have to package it in a way that academics can understand it. And that's not easy.
Sure.
So I'm a little bit schizophrenic now. So I work. The first thing I did was I started working on the problem of integrating programming languages and databases.
Okay.
Because that's one of the key things that I learned about in my startup experience. And had some initial work on that, and then Link came out.
Yes.
And that was interesting. And the fascinating thing is that I now have an alternative or a next generation beyond Link.
You do?
I do. I've discovered, yes.
What is this?
It's called Batches.
Batches.
And what it is, it's a mechanism for writing. It started out as a way of doing better RPC.
Hmm.
Okay. One of the problems with RPC is that every function call in an RPC-style program is a round trip to the server. So I said, well, what if we sent all of the calls at once? And there are other people who have tried to do this.
Okay.
But the difference is that I did a static analysis. So I said, here's a block of code that's known to communicate to a server. It involves lots of fine-grained, object-oriented calls on that server. Let's just partition the code into the server part and the client part. Send all of the server part to the server. Let it execute the whole thing at once.
Mm-hmm.
Collect up all the answers of all the methods, bring them back, and then rerun the remaining client part, plugging in the answers that the server generated.
Yes.
So instead of going back and forth, you go to the server, do all the work the server needs, collect up all the answers, and then run the client loops and run the client conditions and use those values. And it just makes RPC work.
Excellent.
It's just amazing. It also makes web services work better.
Mm.
And it also makes database access work better, because the server could be a database server.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think about it, that's what you do when you write a SQL query. You collect up all the operations you want to happen on the server, you write them in a little script, and you send it over to the server. It generates a bunch of results, and then you process those results on the client.
Mm.
So what I've done is to say, let's automate that process, where you can actually write the code as if you were talking directly to local objects, without all this SQL or anything.
Mm.
It's got loops, it's got conditionals, and just partition it automatically into the SQL part and the client part.
Excellent. Now, how do you partition it? With attribution?
It's actually all you do is you say, what is the root object that represents the remote server data?
Okay.
And then any property that you access off of the root object is also remote. Okay. You say, this is O is remote, so O.items is remote.
Okay.
And if you get for each file in O.items, so file is remote.
Okay.
And then if you say file.name, then that's remote.
Okay.
File.size, that's remote. So you're just doing it's a simple kind of data flow analysis. It's a dependency analysis.
Hmm.
And it's something that the programmer can look at the code and see the dependencies very explicitly. You know if you access this object, then everything that comes from it is, in a sense, tied to it.
Okay.
And then you take all of the operations that involve those remote things and lift them out.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's really good stuff.
Well, and it's also really good for the programmer, the end user programmer.
Yeah, it really works for the end user programmer. I published this, and I have an implementation in Java.
Okay.
And I am hoping to have a chance to propose this as a feature for a future version of Java.
Excellent.
So,
or any other language.
Or it works in any language. And one of the beauties about it is that you can do it in a dynamic language, too.
Interesting.
So you could do this in Ruby or Python or JavaScript as well.
Well, JavaScript would be interesting.
Idea of partitioning the program.
Cool.
So that was my first big hit, and still waiting for it to for people to kind of pick up on this, that we don't have to give up on RPC.
Okay.
You know, this is actually a new way of doing it,
yeah,
and it actually makes it work. Because RPC is actually one of the phenomenal failures of programming language research over the years. RPC, CORBA, DCOM, they all are just crap. I'm sorry. And the reason is that they don't address this issue of latency, and that distance cannot be just pretended that a remote call is the same as a local call.
Absolutely.
You have to do something different.
Yep.
And so if you look at, you know, how many people actually use RPC, right? When the systems people want to do distributed programming, they open up a socket and write text into it. They don't use RPC very much, you know, and certainly distributed objects, RMI, how many, you know, people actually use that stuff. So the point is that it's been so bad for so long that everyone's given up on it. And now I'm coming along and saying, no, there's actually a good way to do this. It's almost like, well, is it too late?
Yeah.
I don't know, but give it another chance.
That's interesting. It kind of reminds me of the work that Eric Meyer, I don't know if you know
yeah,
Eric.
Yeah, I know Eric well.
Volta, with quotes for the legal department.
Yes.
Was essentially an idea where...
Similar to partitioning.
Yes.
Yes, yes. It's similar to that.
Yeah, target equals, you know, some server, or target equals even the GPU or the CPU.
Yes,
they're going to go all over the place with it.
Yeah, so I have an approach to doing that, and it's not surprising that, you know, Eric and I talk a lot, and it's quite good. And actually, this batches approach also uses some of the link technology, some of the styles there, in terms of doing aggregations and things like that.
Sure.
It uses the same approach. So there's some commonality, some differences. So that was good. And now brings us to my most recent and, well, actually, the thing I'm most passionate about is a system I'm working on called ENSO.
Yeah, okay. What is this?
So ENSO is the reinterpretation of all that stuff I told you about at Allegis, with the domain-specific languages and the interpreters and weaving of interpreters together. ENSO is a Japanese word that means circle, and it's not the normal circle. So if you ask a Japanese person about the word ENSO, they probably won't know it. It's a Zen. It means the circle in the sense of Zen, the circle of wholeness and absolute enlightenment, universality.
Okay.
And it also means nothingness. So it's the perfect word for a language or a system. And the system also is very circular.
Okay.
So it's a good name for that, too. So ENSO is a language workbench. It's a way of creating domain-specific languages and integrating them together and making them run. It's a little bit like model-driven development.
Okay.
Similar goals, but I am trying to take a little bit more of a programming language view on this. And one of the things I'm doing different is, rather than doing model transformation, where you transform the models into code, which is essentially writing a compiler, I'm doing model interpretation only. Interpreters.
Okay.
Everybody knows interpreters are actually pretty easy to write. They also compose fairly nicely. If you have two interpreters, one can call the other. You can define interfaces between them. And so I have an environment for creating data descriptions that are interpreted to enforce data constraints, do data binding, a user interface language that allows us to create web pages. I have a graphical grammar, essentially, that allows me to render and create GUI-style applications.
Nice.
And I have an orthogonal security layer. So I've got all these different mini-languages, and I'm getting them all integrated together. And it's just going really great. I actually have tried to do this since I left Allegis. This is my 8th prototype.
Huh.
Every year for the last 8 years, I have tried. And I've tried C#.
Yeah.
I tried Java. I've tried Scheme. I got pretty far in Scheme. I tried Haskell. I've tried this way. I've tried that way. And it's never completely worked until I started working with Thijs Vanderstorm, who is a guy who lives in Amsterdam.
Okay.
He's Dutch. And something about it clicked with him. And he knew Ruby.
Ah.
And so he turned me on to Ruby. It kind of blew my mind.
Interesting.
And now we are implementing ENSO in Ruby.
Hmm.
And we're using the reflective characteristics of Ruby and the sort of, it's hyper-reflective.
Hyper-reflective.
You know, everything about it. So when you ENSO, when you say o.foo, right, or, you know, state machine.current state, any property, it always uses the message not understood mechanism. There is no current, there is no foo property. Mm. There's no code for that. Mm. It says message not understood. What does foo mean? And then we go and look that up in the model. Mm. And then figure out if it needs to have a foo and what its properties are, and then return the appropriate value. So all the objects are essentially just facades.
Interesting. So how is that? Is that related to abstract data types?
The whole ADT abstract data type thing. Oh. No, I don't think so.
Okay.
Abstract data types are all about encapsulation and hiding and protection and preventing bad things from happening.
Okay.
A lot of academia is about preventing bad things from happening. Type checking, you know, static verification. You know, race detection, blah, blah, blah. And I don't do that.
Okay.
There are two styles of research. You can either prevent bad things from happening, or you can try and enable good things to happen.
Interesting.
So I'm on the enable good things to happen camp.
Okay.
And so in that sense, encapsulation is sometimes overrated. It's all about preventing bad stuff. Mm. But if what you want to do is enable good things, you know, maybe you don't worry about some of that safety as much. And so it fits with the use of Ruby.
Okay.
So I'm a funny guy, because I've done all this work on theory of type systems, and I love types, but yeah. Here I am programming in a dynamic language and loving it, so I'm completely schizophrenic.
Interesting. Now, you also do, obviously, implicitly, you're doing a lot of work with partial evaluation.
Yes, and that fits in, too.
Yeah.
And this has been a journey of discovery, so the connection there is that when you write interpreters, in order to make them run fast, what you do is you partially evaluate the interpreter.
Okay.
With respect to the program that it's interpreting. Because the program is essentially a constant. Mm. Source code doesn't change that often. Mm. You write it, it's a literal constant.
Sure.
If you interpret it, then you can specialize the interpreter with respect to the constant program, and what you get is a version of the interpreter that is specialized to run just that one program.
Mm.
And that specialized code is also called the compiled code. You essentially, when you specialize an interpreter with respect to a program, you get the compiled answer. So my approach to making ENSO run fast is to partially evaluate it.
Okay.
My student, Amin Shali, just presented a paper here on partial evaluation, hybrid partial evaluation, it's called.
Mm.
And he got the Best Student Paper Award.
Nice.
Which was fun. And we sort of separated that project from ENSO a little bit.
Okay.
In order to make progress on both of them separately. Because ENSO doesn't really need partial evaluation in order to run. It's just going to be a little slow. We're working on the partial evaluation technology. Mm-hmm. And when it is ready, we can then apply it to ENSO.
Cool.
So the partial evaluation is a partial evaluator for Java. It handles arbitrary, mutable state, mm-hmm. real objects. It basically lets you instantiate any object you want in the compiler.
Mm.
And run part of your program in the compiler.
Interesting.
Okay, so like when you do a regular expression, you typically instantiate a regular expression object with a literal string,
mm-hmm.
which is the regular expression. But every time you run that program, it instantiates the same regular expression object with the same string. And it just dynamically does the same thing over and over again.
Mm.
So what the partial evaluator does, it allows you to mark that as compile time. I want to make that regular expression object a compile time object.
Mm-hmm.
You instantiate the regular expression object with its string in the compiler, and then you specialize the method that matches the regular expression into hard-coded matching code. So what gets output in the residual program, in the resulting program, is essentially a finite state machine.
Hmm.
and just implement that particular regular expression really fast. Mm. So you can get orders of magnitude speedups.
Absolutely.
And it's just,
I mean,
it's great
isn't
stuff.
That essentially what's happening? I mean, maybe loosely in sort of the SQL optimizer kind of model, where you're compiling parts of the of your query to not have to keep.
Well, in some sense, yes. Yeah,
again.
When it does the if you do store procedures, for example,
exactly.
And also SQL Server caches the plan,
yeah.
And so there is some partial evaluation there in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
Also, C++ templates can be thought of as partial evaluation. They essentially do compile time computation.
Yes.
And they can fail to terminate. I don't know if you knew that, but your C++ compiler might not terminate if you write a loop at the template level.
Interesting.
So it's actually Turing complete. You can compute all of your program in the template language if you wanted to.
Yes.
And so what we're doing is allowing you to do compile time computation. And the benefit of this is we're writing more and more flexible frameworks.
Hmm.
The frameworks have more and more kind of generality. They do, but when you actually run them in a particular program, they typically only use a part of that generality or use it in a certain way. And so what we want to do is be able to write very general frameworks, but have them run as fast as if you had written it hard-coded.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what the partial evaluator does. It lets you write very powerful abstract code and then specialize it for the target.
So let me ask you a question then. I mean, with template metaprogramming, even though it's definitely science fiction-y in some level, I mean, if you get to the Andre Alexandrescu level of this template meta madness.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But why didn't you use templates, C++ templates, to implement your partial
evaluators? Well, so C++ templates are interesting. They're not really integrated with the C++ language in a way. They're kind of a bolt-on. So what you can think of this hybrid partial evaluation is allowing you to get a lot of the template-like functionality,
mm-hmm.
but it's just normal C# or Java code.
Okay.
Because what you do is you just say, oh, by the way, this argument here, consider it to be a template argument. You know, it looks like a normal argument to that function.
Mm-hmm.
But if you think about it, in what templates do in C++ is they take some of the arguments of an abstraction and they move it into the template, right, and kind of make it be special.
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe sometimes you want it to be special and sometimes you don't.
Okay,
so why not write it using the normal language, a normal argument, but then have the option of saying, bang, that one is a template argument. Instantiate the code for me.
Got it.
Okay. And you could do that with types. You could do that with integers. You could do it with lots of things. So we're trying to get the feeling of a template language without all the kind of syntactic and complexity overhead.
Sure. Makes sense.
You mentioned one other thing I should at least mention is this whole expression problem, abstract data type, object-oriented programming thing. Everybody thinks that objects are a kind of abstract data type. They aren't. They're two different concepts. They're incompatible.
Interesting.
And you should go and read my essay after. I published this paper in 91 that kind of explained this dichotomy.
Okay.
Again, based on this Reynolds work. And then Wadler picked it up in I don't know, 96 or something. And I thought, oh, I've been out of the world for a while. This has got to be all understood now.
Mm-hmm.
But when I came back, I realized that people still don't understand. In some sense, object-oriented programming is not really well understood at some level. It still has that aha experience, right? You just do it, and then you figure it out. And if you try and explain it in terms of ADTs, abstract data types, you get all confused because it doesn't actually match. It seems to match, but the more you dig into it, the less match there is. So anyway, I wrote an essay that was published a couple years ago in Onward that revisits this and tries to explain what the difference between abstract data types and objects really is. And it's a little bit, I feel now that maybe it was a little too theoretically, you know, embedded. I could have explained it maybe with more simple code.
Okay.
But
instead you use a lot of math.
It's a little bit of math, yeah. So I worry that it's not quite as accessible as I had intended. But I think
so
that
now say it in words. What's the difference? What's the difference? You have, I mean, 2 or 3 minutes.
Okay. The example I use in the paper is integer sets. And if you define an integer set abstract data type, you create a representation, which is a hidden representation, and you make a new type called set. And you define operations on it, like union, element of, all these different things. And actually, people do ADTs in C all the time. You make a header file, you hide the type, because it's just defined as a void star in the header file, and in the actual C file, it gets a struct, okay? And so that works great. So what's the object-oriented version of this? It sounds like I just described objects. Actually, the right way to think about objects is that a set is just a function from integers to Booleans. It's a characteristic function. It's a behavior. Okay. You ask the set, do you have this element? And it can tell you. But the key point is that any function that implements that interface, namely int arrow bool, can act like a set. And so I could create the set of even numbers just by writing a function that when you ask it whether it has an integer in the set, it does mod 2 and gives you the answer. So it's open. It's extensible. There's no hidden representation. And so the way I like to say it is that an object is a collection of behaviors or observations that can be performed upon it. And the other key difference is that in a pure object-oriented style, one object can never know the identity of another object. Maybe the identity is not the right word. It can never know the internal truth of another object.
Interesting.
They can only talk to each other through their public interfaces. Right?
Yeah.
So you think you're talking to a set, but you're actually talking to something that's pretending to be a set. Mm. Okay? And so it's interface-oriented programming. And it turns out that one of the most pure forms of this is Microsoft COM, oddly enough.
Interesting.
And so people don't appreciate it. COM was an incredible learning curve. It's like a learning cliff, right, that you bang your head against.
Sure.
What? And then eventually I got it. It's like, oh, this is just pure interface-based object-oriented programming. And so I would tell you, if you really want to do object-oriented programming, you should never use classes as types. Only use interfaces.
Mm.
And basically, the word a class name should only be used after the keyword new.
Okay.
That's the only purpose of a class is to create objects.
Interesting.
The minute you start using it as a type, what you're doing is you're saying not just that this value has a particular behavior, but it has some required internal structure. Mm. Right? It has to be a subclass of this particular implementation. Mm. And the minute you do that, you limit the flexibility. Objects are designed to be as flexible as possible, and interface is the way to make that happen.
Excellent.
So,
well, I like what you said about COM, because if you think about what's going on, at least in the Microsoft world, with our upcoming programming model for a form factor of Windows running on a tablet with WinRT.
I heard about this.
Yes.
That they're kind of recreating the COM. Yeah.
COM reimagined.
I just heard about that yesterday. That's why I come to Splash.
Excellent.
One other thing I should mention is that I am on the steering committee for Splash. So I should say a little bit about Splash.
Please
and how
do.
We have all these great things going on. We've had Scheme Workshop, the dynamic languages. We're co-located with Gypsy. Mm. We have Onward. We have Uppsala, of course, as the core academic conference. We have the Wavefront, which is a new thing that's designed to kind of refresh the appeal of Splash to practitioners.
Excellent.
Okay. I know that a lot
programmers.
Of practitioners. Programmers.
Yes.
Programmers, designers, developers. Yes. I shouldn't use the word practitioner. Professional programmers.
Okay.
Amateur programmers. Yes. I'm a programmer. That's how
I started, right? Yes, it is.
So it appeals to me, too. I'm still a programmer. I program every day if I can.
Great.
And so Wavefront is bringing in tech talks and programmer kind of technical briefings, things that are happening here and now. It's a little bit more in the style of JAU or QCon.
Yep.
And
now
you know, in some ways,
GoTo.
Or GoTo, sorry. I cannot believe they renamed it GoTo.
Me neither.
It's like, wow. I know it's the GoTo conference, but anyway. So in some sense, Uppsala invented JAU's business model. I don't know if people realize that, but you know, in the early days, Uppsala had this incredible energy about the thought leaders coming and presenting the hot new thing, and we had audiences with 1,000 people in the room listening to, you know, people were kind of reinventing the world with objects. And then I think that some people noticed, wow, Uppsala's making a lot of money on this. Maybe we can do it better. We're just an amateur outfit. Mm. So when you put it together, a company that's designed to put on these kind of productions, it kind of stole our thunder a little bit, I think. But what I'm interested in is well, okay, so everything evolves, things change.
Yes.
How can Splash continue to participate in that dialogue, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that we're kind of on one end of the spectrum with, you know, a little bit more of the academic tilt, but we still have about 50% programmer professional involvement.
Okay.
Depending on how you measure it, it might be 30, 50%. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty healthy. And so I want to find ways to kind of work with the situation on the field. And
If
we can co-locate with other conferences or, you know, a branch of QCon, or we've even talked about that, that would be great. I think there's a lot of synergy still between the kind of academic side and the business side. And one thing I completely reject is the idea that academics do stuff and then business people, you know, implement the theory. It's not that way.
No.
You know, out in the industry, there are all kinds of interesting things going on. And just as often, academics are coming along and reanalyzing and understanding and providing maybe some conceptual framework for the stuff that's going on in business, in the professional world. And it goes both ways.
Yes, it does.
So,
in some sense, when you think about it, if there was a better synergy between academia and the real world, meaning programmers who write code for a living, building products that companies then sell, maybe small talk would be the much more popular than it is.
Yeah. So there's interesting issues of why that is. I can tell you my opinion, but we shouldn't get into that.
Okay.
I think the and that's really my mission, is that I have been out in industry. I'm in academia.
Yes.
I'm the schizophrenic bridge. When I hang out with academics, they actually view me often as sort of the practical guy. Obviously, when I hang out with programmers, there I'm like the theory guy.
Yeah.
So I don't really fit in anywhere, but I can speak the language and really understand. So I'm trying to, in my own little way, bridge that gap.
Cool. Well, hey, this is a great event, and I'm very happy to be here.
Thank you for coming.
Of course.
It's fantastic.
We will come again, and I like the idea of the co-location with, if you, by more explicitly mixing the great talks that you guys provide as academics. In your case, you're also a practitioner, but in the end of the day, it's the frontline developers that have to program concurrent systems, and they don't have the benefit of stepping back and going, well, we could try the actor-based model, or maybe we'll try this model here.
Yes.
So, I mean, exactly. It's interesting.
It's good.
So right on. Nice to
meet
you.
Thank you.
Great work.
All right.
Cheers.